The one thing in delusional disorder that patients don't want to give up is the very thing that we're trying to change. How do we even start the conversation? Welcome to the Carlyle Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlyle Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. With all that's written about psychopharmacology in our field, it can seem like psychiatry is all about understanding medications, side effects, and drug interactions. But psychopharmacology is the easy part of our work. The greater challenge is connecting with people who think and feel very different from ourselves. In this month's report, we feature a review of delusional disorder. There are a few medication tips in there, like why pimazide is no longer first line. But overall, we conclude that the evidence for antipsychotics is sorely lacking in delusional disorder.
There are many types of psychosis: manic psychosis, depressive psychosis, drug-induced, dementia-related, medical-related, schizophrenia, schizotypal, and delusional disorder. You know, it's funny in psychiatry how we spend so much time parsing apart the disorders and then expect that they're all going to respond to the same treatment, like in this case, an antipsychotic. That would be like expecting every fever to respond to penicillin. And indeed, they don't. Delusional disorder can respond to antipsychotics, but the response is not as great as what we see with schizophrenia. Today, we talk with psychiatrist Michael Pasternak on how to help patients manage their delusions when they don't respond to medications. Michael, you have a long-standing interest in delusions. How did that start?
I started out in the mental health field working as a mental health counselor for 3 years. So I spent 3 years working as on the inpatient unit and fell in love with the field and ended up going to med school after that. There was one patient who I recall who really stood out, and she was a nurse, very bright, very articulate, but she had this unusual belief that her soul had been transposed by someone from the 14th century, and that gave her special powers. And I was fascinated by the fact that she was very bright, intelligent, in every respect. She was normal, but she had a very unusual set of beliefs. These powers that she had suggested to her that she could do things like make the moon move at will and speak 8 languages and that type of thing. So I remember I asked her to come outside with me, and she was willing to go along and say, "Can you show me how you make the moon move?" So we went outside, and she was not successful doing it. And we went back inside, and since I speak French, I asked her to write down a sentence in French that translate for me, and she struggled with that. And the interesting thing was she tried to do it. She put the pen to the paper, but she was not successful. When I asked her, "Why couldn't you make the moon move, and why do you think you couldn't speak 8 languages? She sort of said things like, "Well, it was kind of cloudy outside," and she said, "I was tired and I had a long day." So there was something about the fact that she wasn't able to correct her belief system and that she was going to fit whatever happened into her beliefs.
What have you learned along the way about how to talk to patients with delusions?
Delusional patients, I think, are uniquely challenging. We don't see it much. I mean, delusions are rare in an outpatient practice where I work, under 1% of patients in clinical practice, both in mine and in other practices that people have looked at, do have delusions. So it's not something we encounter a lot of, which means we may not have a lot of experience dealing with it. And I think delusions present the challenge because oftentimes, just like this patient, they're very intelligent, and they're very bright, and they often understand that other people perceive them to be crazy. And they're walking into a psychiatrist's office, and so they're very anxious about the fact that you may stamp them, or I may stamp them, with the notion that they're crazy. And they're often very convinced that what they're saying is correct. And so it's a balancing act in trying to validate their experience, but not try to support their false belief.
And how do you support the patient without supporting their delusions?
The most common delusion that people suffer from is paranoid delusions. And oftentimes they come in, no one says I'm delusional. Oftentimes they come in because they'll say my husband or my wife or my mother or my father, or somebody says I need to see a psychiatrist, and they're highly stressed, and so they're coming in at someone else's request. And so someone may say something like, "There's 20 people out there. I don't know who they are, but they've hacked my computer and they follow me around wherever I go and I'm in my car." And so that's sort of a typical story, let's say, for someone with a paranoid psychosis. They may have gone to the police several times. They may have contacted the CIA. Obviously, they're running into dead ends at each place they go to. And so what they want from me is they want to validate that they're correct. And obviously, that's a trap not to get into. You know, I want to first hear their whole story, not just about their delusions, about their whole life, you know, their life story. But when we get into delusions, I really want to try to sidestep this question of, am I going to judge them or not? And is what they're saying true or not? And generally, what I'll say is something to the effect that, listen, you know, I'm not a private detective. Some people are followed out there. Maybe you're one of them. I'm not sure. But my job is not to sort of say who's right, you or your family. I'm just trying to help you deal with this really stressful experience. And let's see if we can figure out a way to do that.
And how do you help them function better in the world?
You know, typically by the time they come into your office, it won't be a week or two that they'll have been delusional. It'll often be a year or much longer than that. And so, you know, they'll talk about these great conspiracies, but I'll ask them, what have they done to you so far? I mean, have they, you know, they might say they've been hacked, but I'll ask them, you know, is it possible they're trying to hurt you, trying to kill you? You know, what are they trying to do? And the answer, of course, is no. Obviously, if they wanted to kill you, they would have killed you by now, and they fully acknowledge that. We establish the fact that they're not in any type of danger or jeopardy, because if they were, it would have already happened by now. So basically, they're being followed. There's this potential conspiracy out there. And now our task is, how do we deal with this conspiracy? The FBI doesn't seem like they're going to help. The police are going to think you're crazy. And they generally can acknowledge that. So now we have to live with the fact that there's these people out there doing this. How can we best do that?
Do you get to work with families in these cases?
Well, I would say not that I get to work. I would say it's almost mandatory to have to work with the patients, because it's the families that's most affected. The patients, while they're delusional, don't realize they have any psychiatric illness. The family, of course, is very aware that this sounds crazy, it's not possible, and they've often engaged in repeated dialogues over and over, arguments about whether this is true or not true, that are just completely dead ends. And so anytime someone comes in with delusions, it's really mandatory to invite the families in, and I do it in conjunction with the patients. I certainly don't want to do it behind their backs, and have a discussion with the families about how to cope with this difference in perspectives that exists between the family and the patient.
What are some of the common solutions you come up with families?
It's even more of a balancing act when you have the family in. You're going to have to speak to both parties using the same words, but different messages to the same people. Meaning you're going to talk to the patient as if this may be happening, but talk to the family where you both know that this is not happening. And so it's about the fact that you're, again, not going to make a judgment about the truth of it. These things sound unlikely to be true, but emphasize the fact that engaging in a reasoned discussion of the facts is just not going to solve their problem for them. And I encourage the family not to engage in those discussions, to sidestep them.
Is it ever hard to figure out if the delusions are true?
Well, the truth is, I'm not spending a lot of effort trying to figure out if it's true or not true, so I don't really wrestle with that question too much. I think most of the time, the delusions are quite apparent. So someone may be followed by, let's say, one person. That's plausible in life. You could be followed by one person. Another example, which is actually more common, is about fidelity of a spouse. So a lot of times people are worried that their spouse is having an affair. And obviously that's certainly something that does happen in life. And again, I don't spend a lot of time trying to figure out whether it's not true, because that's kind of a trap. It's just a matter of how you want to cope with that anxiety that they have.
Yeah, it's always possible that they could have delusional jealousy and their spouse could still be cheating on them. But if the patient's goal is to save their marriage, the solution is usually to stop badgering their spouse and stop tracking everywhere they go.
And the judgment about delusion hinges a little bit on what's their grounds for suspecting that their wife is unfaithful. If they say, you know, there's a box of Kleenex that moved and, you know, there's airplanes flying above, it's obviously quite obvious it's delusional, even if their wife was truly having an affair. But often it's murky and the goal is still the same, which is to engage in a collaborative discussion and not become a private investigator.
How do you talk about medications with people who have delusional disorder?
So, great question. Medications are a very tricky subject, which I encourage people to really approach delicately. Again, patients come in with a fear that you are going to stamp them as crazy. And if you push antipsychotics on them, most of them are going to be intelligent and going to realize that you think they're crazy, whether you said that or not. So I think antipsychotics should be approached very gingerly. Some of this depends on your rapport. Sometimes you'll have met the person just for the first time. Sometimes you may have had a 10-year relationship. So obviously there's a lot of variables in that equation. But generally, I'll start with the premise that you do not need to prescribe an antipsychotic to someone with delusions. And the reason is they're generally not very effective. And so it's not medically necessary, in my opinion, to prescribe an antipsychotic. A lot of the work can be done through engaging in collaborative discussion and de-escalating and changing behavior and family education. If they're delusional and they're often stressed, which they often report, I do suggest that maybe these medications can help reduce the stress. I don't label them as antipsychotics, but don't shy away from it if they ask either, because I do feel you need to be truthful with them. So I reserve them. If they're asking for medications and we're conceptualizing as stress around this stuff, I say this may help you feel less stressed about this stuff. And sometimes it does, but it's generally not going to get rid of a delusion. That's a tall task to order for a medication.
I imagine the patient would not want to get rid of the delusion because then they would be duped, fooled, and easily taken advantage of by their persecutors.
That's never their goal because they don't feel it's a delusion. So we never state that explicitly as a goal. It just reduces the stress around having this set of beliefs and how stressful their life has become because of this.
To clarify, antipsychotics are effective in delusions due to schizophrenia, mania, and depression. When you said they were not necessary and aren't very effective, you're speaking of delusional disorder, right?
Yeah, I think delusions, you know, can present in many different disorders. Each one requires a different approach. Yes, and absolutely, psychotic depression, mania, medications are going to be the cornerstone. Schizophrenia, they're going to play a role. And whether they have a thought disorder or not will be a big variable in whether you're able to collaborate in the way that I was suggesting before. Obviously, neurological diseases are going to limit your capacity, potentially. So mostly this is in the realm of delusional disorder.
Any other tips you have?
One of the things that I always try to keep in my mind is the movie The Terminator. And I imagine from the scene from The Terminator where the psychologist is evaluating, he's telling this far-fetched story of someone coming from the future.
Why didn't you bring any weapons? Something more advanced? Don't you have ray guns?
You go naked. Something about the field generated by a living organism. Nothing dead will go.
But this cyborg, if it's metal...
Surrounded by living tissue.
All right.
This is great stuff. I could make a career out of this guy. You see how clever this part is? How it doesn't require a shred of proof? And most paranoid delusions are intricate, but this is brilliant.
And I try to remind myself, I don't want to be in Terminator 6 being portrayed as someone who didn't believe something that was true. And it's just sort of an anchor for me to remind myself that just to validate the patient's experience, that to be humble about what's going on and to really come from that position at an emotional level and go where the patient's coming from.
Michael Pasternak is a psychiatrist in private practice in Boston, Massachusetts. His research, which includes over 50 peer-reviewed publications, has advanced our understanding of antidepressant therapy, and he is a regular contributor to the Carlat Report. And now for the word of the day, the beads task.
The beads task was the first study to suggest that delusional disorder is about something more than just false beliefs. Delusional disorder also involves a different way of thinking and processing information. In the study, participants were shown two jars of beads. One of them was mostly filled with pink beads. It was 85% pink and 15% green. And the other was a mostly green jar, 85% green and only 15% pink. The jars were then hidden, and the participants were shown a sequence of beads drawn from the container and asked to guess which container it was drawn from. So if you're seeing a lot of pink, you're going to guess it's from the pink jar. But how many beads would you wait until you ventured your guess? Maybe 2? Maybe 5? Maybe 10? In this study, people with delusional disorder ventured a guess after way fewer beads were drawn than everyday people did. In other words, they were jumping to conclusion on limited data and willing to accept hypotheses based on scarce evidence. Since then, over a dozen similar studies have documented the same thing. And look carefully, it's something that you'll see in your practice. For example, just as you start to talk about a medication or a behavioral intervention or any idea with a patient who has delusional disorder, they might just jump in, reaching conclusions that you've barely suggested by your words. Knowing that, you gotta parse what you say carefully.
You can read the full articles and earn CME credits at thecarlivereport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You can get $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST.
The Carlyle Report is one of few CME publications that depends entirely on its subscribers for support. Thank you for helping us stay free of industry support.